Welcome to the World War I History Podcast, produced by the MacArthur Memorial. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at MacArthur1880 or find the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial on Facebook. This podcast was sponsored by the Ernst and Gertrude Tycho Charitable Foundation. When World War I began in 1914, Catholic priests were virtual pariahs in France. This was the result of a trend towards anti-clericalism that began with the French Revolution and continued in fits and starts into the 20th century. Prior to World War I, to further eliminate perceived privilege, France's Third Republic made priests eligible for military service. Ironically, though, this attempt to erase them as a distinct social class provided French priests the opportunity to be seen as patriots. Tens of thousands of priests served in the French army during World War I, alongside nearly two-thirds of France's male population. And today we're going to explore this novel chapter in World War I history. And we are joined by Dr. Anita May, author of Patriot Priests, French Catholic Clergy, and National Identity in World War I. Welcome, Dr. May.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
To start off with, could you explain anti-clericalism, and can you explain the difference between U.S. and French concepts of separation of church and state?
Yes. Well, if you look up the definition of anti-clericalism in Encyclopedia Britannica, for example, it says it's opposition to the clergy for its real or alleged influence in political and social affairs, for its doctrinarism, and for its privileges or property, or for any other reason. But I would like to explain to your audience that this just touches the sentiment behind it. First of all, back in the 18th century, when anti-clericalism was first sort of spread in France, one of its proponents was Voltaire, and he said, écrasez l'enfant, in reference to the Catholic Church, and it's crush the evil one. Interesting that he uses the word evil in that context, but in any event. And then in the Third Republic, when the Republicans who favored Republican government got control of the government, they said that they thought of the clergy as a black-robed army in the service of a foreign power. They meant Rome, of course. And so I think that to understand anti-clericalism and the place of the priest by the beginning of the war, you have to understand that the invective was just about as powerful as contemporary political invective is. And some of the sentiment behind it was similar. So the Catholic Church was the enemy as far as the Third Republic was concerned, and they wanted to limit its influence. So that's anti-clericalism. You know, it comes from the experience, of course, of French history. In the old monarchy, the church and state were completely entwined. Probably everybody's heard of Cardinal Richelieu. He was the prime minister, so to speak, of the monarch for a little while, and he was a cardinal in the Catholic Church. So you can see that that was totally entwined. And the church supported the government, and the government supported the church. And that's not happened in American history, particularly since we had the revolution in the Constitution. It might have been true in early days of Massachusetts, where there was an intertwining of church and state, but not in America as it was founded by the Constitution. And so it's really difficult for us to understand the bitterness behind this anti-clericalism that existed. But in France, anti-clericalism believes that they want to protect the individual from the claims of religion, which are seen as inhibiting a citizen from free will and burdening him with superstitious, unscientific beliefs. While in America, our concept is based on the idea of keeping all churches free from state control and preventing the state from establishing one religious denomination as the state religion. So it's a completely different kind of almost unemotional idea that we have. And so it's very difficult to understand this, especially this time in history when the French were passing these laws that were so antagonistic to the Catholic Church.
It's such a fascinating distinction. Thanks for laying that out for us. Now, can you set the stage for us? Can you outline the pre-war relationship between the Catholic Church and the Third Republic? You've already touched on this a little bit, but just in a little more detail, and tell us how this impacts the status of French priests in society.
The Third Republic was established after the defeat of Louis Napoleon, who had established the Second Empire, it was called, and he was the emperor. And after the French Revolution, it's a little complicated for anybody who doesn't understand France, the Bourbon monarchy was restored for a time, and there was another revolution, and there was an Orleanist monarchy. And then there was, for a short period of time, the Second Republic. The First Republic was during the French Revolution. The Second Republic was in 1848. But Louis Napoleon came to power in 1852, and established what he called the Second Empire, the First Empire being the empire of Napoleon Bonaparte, who was his uncle. And in all of this transition, every time that a monarchy or in terms of the empire was in place, the church was granted more freedom and more liberty. Never did they restore the privileges and the property that were taken away in the French Revolution. French Revolution confiscated church property and actually made clergy marry if they were going to stay in France and take an oath to the French Revolution. That never happened again in that profound way. And when Napoleon came into power, he established a concordat with the Pope in 1801, which is also extremely peculiar to Americans, because in this concordat, he recognized the Catholic religion is the religion of the majority of the French people. But what he did was he set up the clergy of all denominations, including Protestants and Jews, as civil servants. And so there was a ministry of worship that administered the appointments of the leaders of the church. For instance, the government would propose several people to the Pope to become bishop. And then the Pope was free to choose among those three. And there were extensive examinations as if, you know, it was some kind of, they expected them to be some kind of spies into their background, etc., before they could be approved by the state of France and then given over to the Pope. And it's very interesting then that the ministers of the Catholic Church and Protestant and Jewish were all civil servants. And the church was supported by public funds. So all the buildings, et cetera, were supported by public funds. It was not necessary to raise money to support the churches or the salaries of the incumbent priests or bishops. But what happened because of the burgeoning anti-clericalism in the Third Republic, the privileges, so to speak, that were given to the clergy and the Catholic Church under the Second Empire, which was a much greater control in education, primarily that, and giving local clergy importance in secular affairs in various provinces and towns, they wanted to take all of that away. And because the Catholic Church seemed to want to restore the monarchy, that was the big animosity at that time. There were a number of bishops who'd be documented as supporting the return of the Bourbon monarchy. And in the opening days of the Third Republic, the Chamber of Deputies was controlled by a royalist party. So it looked like it could be possible, but the people in France were really not ready for that. And there were more people who wanted Republican government than not. But when the Republicans got in charge, they were so paranoid, I have to say, about the power of the Catholic Church that they wanted to restrict their power. And they particularly were interested in education. So they started They didn't have at this time public schools for the primary grades. They were mostly in the hands of nuns and priests, and that all changed. That was one of the primary things. And then they took away power to give advanced degrees as well, and because they felt that education was the primary way in which the church was influencing people. They were particularly afraid of religious orders, and I would have to say they were most afraid of the Jesuits, probably, but they passed a law to exile. Well, nobody could be in a religious order and stay in France. You couldn't live communally in France. So many of the religious orders set up houses in Belgium and in England, and of course they had missions, so a lot of them were in South America, and they weren't in France anymore. You could not be in France and be in a religious order after they passed these laws. And then, of course, they decided that one of the things that attracted men to the priesthood was that they didn't have to serve in the military. So that's when they decided to end the exemption of the clergy from military service. So they did that in 1885, I believe. But at that time, they said that if they trained, they drafted people kind of initially for training. And after their period of training, if war broke out, they said that they could choose a non-combat position. After 1905, when they separated church and state, they made a new law about military service. And they said that nobody inducted after 1905 could choose a non-combat position. So that's why, in the end, there were 33,000 Catholic priests and seminarians in the military, and about half of them were in combat. And the others, a lot of them were nurses and stretcher bearers. So they were in non-combat positions, but they were basically, especially the stretcher bearers, were at the front. I have this, what I consider one of the most descriptive quotes of how the priests were treated at the beginning of the war, just their position in French society. And I'd like to just read this because it's one of my favorite descriptions of how they felt, because this is, you can see this in the letters when war breaks out, how they feel about their positions. And in 1892, a journalist wrote in one of the largest publications in France about the positions of the priests. He said that they were banished from the school, excluded from the committee directing official charities, regarded with malicious distrust or jealous hatred by the mayor and the schoolmaster. They were kept at arm's length as a compromising neighbor by all the minor officials employed by the commune or the state. They were spied on by the innkeeper, exposed to the anonymous denunciations of the local newspaper. The priest spends his morning reciting prayers to empty pews and his afternoons planting cabbages and pruning roses. That's the way they felt, and that's the experience. And that's all of the things in sort of graphic detail that they used to be involved in, but they couldn't be involved in anymore. And then they also took away the church's, they would call it control over marriage. You had to be married by civil authorities. You couldn't be married the other way. And your birth and death had to be registered civilly. It wasn't sufficient that it would be registered by the Catholic Church. So that just kind of, I think it's more graphic than anything I've said to listen to that little quote from the newspaper.
For sure. So when the French army mobilizes in 1914, how do the priests respond?
Well, that's the amazing thing. So this is how they're treated, right? This is their exiles. Many of them are that had their initial training in France are in religious orders, and they're exiled. They're someplace. They're Belgium, England, whatever. They were called back, and they came. In some ways, if you look at the statistics, there's some possibility of miscalculation about people coming from the missions in South America, but there's no miscalculation about them coming from exile in Europe, Belgium, and England. And so why did they come? Well, they came because actually they were Frenchmen. And regardless of what the Third Republic thought of them, they loved their country. And they were appalled to have it invaded by the Germans. And they wanted to prove that they were patriotic as well. They also had been influenced by the accusations of the time that religion was a feminizing thing, and they hoped to prove otherwise. They used to tease them that they were walking around in skirts, so they must be girls. And one of the men who had brothers in the military wrote that he wanted to be like the brothers, like his brothers, and join the military. So all those reasons made them come back. But they're Frenchmen, and Germany invaded France. Big deal. So that's why they came. And it was really a phenomenon when you think about it. But it worked to the disadvantage, like you said in your introduction, because this put all of those priests into these positions with the 8 million men that the French drafted. You know, the French drafted people in classes, and so they drafted men who were up to 40 years old. That's how they got 8 million people in the military. And so they didn't have too much respect for age either. So in terms of how many priests served as chaplains in the whole war, only 1,500 French priests served as chaplains. And to compare that, the British had one chaplain for every 4,000 men, and the Canadians had one chaplain for every 1,000 men.
Big difference.
Yeah, right. The priests that were in combat and in nursing situations, they were able to act as priests when their commanding officers kind of looked the other way, when they had the time, when they were there. Even though they weren't officially chaplains, they were there.
You've explained that some of them are chaplains. They're providing spiritual comfort. They're helping with morale. Some of them are performing kind of medical support roles. They're also, as you've mentioned, combatants. They're with other French soldiers mm-hmm. who are going to be in combat. They're right beside them mm-hmm. as fellow combatants. How does the Catholic Church view this kind of military service for them? And do the priests struggle with being combatants?
Oh, yeah. Well, the bishops were appalled by the first law ending the clerical exemption in 1889. But when the war began, they rallied to the French cause. Cardinal Amat, who was the Archbishop of Paris at the time, he said that he wanted the Catholics to be the first to respond to the call for Union Sacrée. And so they responded just loyally, I would have to say. And even though canon law actually prohibits clergy from engaging in combat, but even the Vatican granted a special dispensation for priests who were conscripted by their government to be in combat. So they were completely cooperative. But then the other thing about it was that they quickly saw it as a way to prove their loyalty to France, which was much demeaned by the Third Republic. You remember that I said that they were a black-robed army in the service of a foreign power, and that's a pretty heavy accusation. So they wanted to prove that they were loyal to their country, and so they thought that this was a really excellent proof to have the priests serve in the armed forces.
You profile a number of priests in your book. Could you share a few of their stories?
Yes, and that answers your question about how they reacted to combat. I've got a number of priests that I can talk about. I have to say my favorite and one of the most articulate of the priests is a Jesuit who became very famous in later life as he's a paleontologist, and he's also a philosopher, and his name is Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And he came from a noble family in Clermont-Ferrand, and they had a tradition, of course, of military service. And it was he who wanted to be like his brothers because his brothers were all in the military. They had 6 sons. They were all in the military. And one of them, by the time he was called up, had just been killed. And so he's the one that said he wanted to be like the others, and he wanted to share in this experience, and stated, "For us soldier priests, war was a baptism into reality." And that's one of the things he thought about it. But he was hopeful that by that service, he would have some influence with his fellow troops. And when he first went into the war, he thought that was a distinct possibility. After a while, he began to believe that he wasn't having very much influence, but he stayed. But, you know, he had purposely chosen, because he was in the class before 1905, a non-combat position. And I think that one of the things that was most astonishing to me is what he wrote in February of 1917 to his cousin. He was that most of what I know about him. He published in the war was published in letters to his cousin Marguerite. And he said, "I assure you that I'd 1,000 times rather be throwing grenades or handling a machine gun than be supernumerary as I am now. What I'm going to say may not be very orthodox, and yet I believe there's a core of truth in it. I feel that doing so, I would be more a priest. Isn't a priest a man who has to bear the burden of life in all its forms and shows by his own life how human work and love of God can be combined? I'd be interested to know how many of us soldier priests think the same. I don't know whether I should react against this tendency, but I feel that I'm not being honest with myself unless I say what I think. If I said anything else, I'd be doing violence to my own self. Fundamentally, however, since we seem to be approaching the end of the war, it is really an academic question. But if I had to start again, I wouldn't take the line I did in 1914 of choosing a non-combat position." I think that was one of the most startling revelations that I ran into in studying the reactions of these priests. The other thing was, later on, he described this, which is on the lips of many soldiers, priests, and non-soldiers. He said later in 1917, he wrote his cousin again, and he said that he was working on a book, which he was calling Nostalgia for the Front. And he explained that he wanted to describe the feeling and provide some reason for it. He wrote, "The reasons, I believe, come down to this. The front cannot but attract us because it is, in one way, the extreme boundary between what one is already aware of and what is still in the process of formation. Not only does one see there things that you experienced nowhere else, but one also sees emerge from within one an underlying stream of clarity, energy, and freedom that is to be found hardly anywhere else in ordinary life. And the new form that the soul then takes on is that of the individual living the quasi-collective life of all men, fulfilling a function for far higher than that of the individual and becoming fully conscious of this new state. It goes without saying that at the front, you no longer look on things in the same way as you do in the rear. If you did, the signs you see in the life you lead would be more than you could bear. The exaltation is accompanied by a certain pain. Nevertheless, it is indeed an exaltation, and that's why one likes the front in spite of everything and misses it." And he is not the only one that said things like that, which is really fascinating.
Definitely. Do you have any other stories?
Well, when the priests got into the war, they were acutely aware that people didn't like them. And so any example of acceptance was very moving for them. And at the beginning of the war, I guess because Napoleon was right that France is a Catholic country, whether the Republicans liked it or not, people flooded to the churches. And when the priests were going off to war, they were given accolades. There was one group of Franciscans who returned on a train, and they said they were met at the station with praise and accolades by the crowd. Here come the priests. So they were kind of amazed, but it was still difficult for them to go into the barracks, and especially for some of the young seminarians. And I think they were very, very unsure of themselves. And this one 23-year-old seminarian, whose name is Bernard Laverne, was pretty, I guess, uncertain. But he felt better after a while in barracks, and he wrote to his cousin that she was right to believe that he could have some influence over the other soldiers. She said, "You cannot imagine, but yes, it is you who told me so on Sunday, how much good one can accomplish with the soldiers. This daily contact with the men places us in a position to show them very well. Moreover, they are often simple and trusting, especially in the regiments." He believed that a discreet apostolate would be the most effective to lead men back to the faith. He had great confidence in his beliefs and thought that his best preaching would be his silent example of faith. And he was an extremely brave young soldier, and his fate was pretty awful. But at first, he was also extremely proud to be in the military because his father had been in the military, and he wrote his father about his service. But then he wrote another letter, just to show you how conflicted these young men can be. He wrote another letter to his female cousin. "The war we are going to make, if you knew the métier we have learned, whose tiniest details they have taught us, this will be offensive war, incessant attack on entrenched positions, attack day and night, and always with bayonets. What will be hard, finally, is to jump into one trench, then another, to find men who will cry out, perhaps on their knees, 'Comrades, comrades,' and then to have the instruction, the order, the duty to kill them all the same. I am going to say some horrible things if I continue, and moreover, that is that I have some buddies who have done this already. I do not fear death, but if it is necessary to get into hand-to-hand fighting, how will I close my eyes without seeing before me their mother, their wife, their children? How will I repeat to the divine model the words I have often said, 'What would you have done, Jesus, in these circumstances?'" So you can see that they can be really torn up at the same time as they're glad to be defending their country. So it's just really very, very moving, the experience, I think.
It is very moving. Now, fraternity is a major part of French national identity. And during the war, we already mentioned that about 2/3 of French men are mobilized. And as you've laid out, there are a lot of French priests sharing the hardships and daily lives of these men. Does this contact ultimately undermine anti-clericalism in the Third Republic?
Well, it seems to. In a number of instances after the war, there were attempts by the Republican government to re-exile the religious orders and do various things to reinforce the anti-clerical laws. And when they were put in place, the interesting part about it is when they were put in place at the end of the 19th century, even the Catholics didn't protest very much. But after the war, not only did the Catholics protest, but a lot of other people joined them in this protest. And then finally, a prime minister came to power, Millerand, who said, you know, how can we send back into exile these people who came here to fight for us in the war? How can we do this? But further than that, the priest had become an integral part of a lot of the lives, not only of the priests, but of their relatives, because one of the things that they did was they buried men in marked graves. There was one priest in particular, Achille Leonard, who later became the Archbishop of Lille. He made it his mission to go and bury the dead in marked graves and identify the dead and write to their relatives. And so they were integral in the kind of memory that not only the soldiers had, but of the relatives and parents. One of the things I read was by a man who studied what happened to veterans after the war. And one of the interesting things that what he said is the most long-lasting feeling that gave meaning to the war experience for the veterans was the experience of brotherhood. It was not patriotism that they carried with them into the post-war period, but this feeling of brotherhood that they adapted at the front. And one of the things that was true and that you could see in all the letters and memoirs was that the priest at the front, whether he was in combat or not, was very supportive of his fellow soldiers and in some ways made meaning of the war. So, you know, of course, in the Christian religion, suffering is equated with Jesus. And so it's this kind of idea that they would impart to the soldiers that suffering was a valid experience gave to a number of them, anyway, a sense of meaning. And these are the only things that I ever read about World War I in terms of really articulate explanation, as opposed to the British poets and some of their accounts of the war, is that it comes out in experience that this war is meaningless. But these priests had this ability to impart meaning by their definition of the value of sacrifice and brotherhood that they felt for each other. So there's a lot of support after the war for former priests and former priests who had been priests who had formerly been at the front. And a number of them, there's a man who did a study of how many of them subsequently became bishops, and a number of them did, a good number of them did, actually. And when they did, the people who served with them came out to congratulate them. And so you had this sense that even though many of them were not regular attenders of church services, that they had this fondness for the clergy, which made it impossible for the French government to reinforce the secular laws. And so it was a big deal that they did earn respect, and it filtered into the post-war period for many of them. You don't really change after an experience like that, your attitude towards your fellow soldiers.
In 1920, Pope Benedict XV canonized Joan of Arc. It's the beginning of a period of improvement in the relationship between France and the Catholic Church. Does this happen without the service of French priests in World War I?
Well, I don't think so, you know, because as I said, initially the Republicans wanted to reinstate, they called their anti-clerical law sacrosanct. And so one of the interesting things was they had a number of negotiations, and that was in the negotiations that I quoted the Millerand and what he said about he couldn't see sending away the men who had come to France to be a part of the war effort and then to send them into exile because they're members of religious orders. So in the 1920s, although there were a number of negotiations between the Vatican and the bishops and the church, and in the negotiations with the men in the Chamber of Deputies, finally the Archbishop of Paris, who is still Cardinal Amet, agreed to compromise language that although those anti-clerical laws would stay on the book, the new government would understand that, as they put it, secularization must be harmonized with the liberties and the rights of all citizens, whatever their religious views. And in this way, religious peace will be assured to the country. And then Benedict XV, who negotiated with the government, then settled some of the disputes that previously had occurred between the Vatican and the state. And so the canonization of Joan of Arc was kind of symbolic of the growing sentiment of peace between the church and the Third Republic.
Any final thoughts on this topic?
It really is difficult for an American to understand, I have to say, because we just don't have the same experience at all. But one of the things that was clear is that you can't expect people to go through a war without being changed by it. And if it's to produce despair, as it was for many people, then that's awful. But I think the participation of the priests and their attitudes helped a number of people not despair. And that was a really important thing. And it also seems to me that it was a way of bringing a kind of a reconciliation that wouldn't have been possible without it between the Catholic Church and the government of France. And I think that was really important. It was also important that the priests recognized, and they said this over and over again themselves, that even if they couldn't get men back into the church, they could still accept them as brothers. And that was a big thing on both sides, that they came to regard each other as fellow human beings, fellow sufferers, and fellow survivors. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I have to say that, you know, especially in terms of brotherhood, a number of my friends that were soldiers, and they identified with my priest a great deal in their experience of service. And I was gratified hearing what they thought of the book. So,
well, it was a very interesting work, and I really appreciate you joining us today to share your research with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email MacArthurMemorial@norfolk.gov.